The clock is running out on the ceasefire today, Thursday, August 7th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. A 72-hour ceasefire in Gaza is supposed to expire tomorrow. In Gaza City, one father says his children keep asking the same question.
What's going to happen? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? You can see the fear in their eyes.
Plus, a graphic artist heads to Dubai to document the lives of foreign laborers in what are called worker cities.
The guys on these worker cities live 10 to a room in this sort of desolate Pyongyang-style atmosphere.
And the American scientists who use mitochondrial DNA to help Argentina's grandmothers find their missing loved ones.
The grandmothers like to say that this proves that God is a woman because she put mitochondrial DNA on Earth specifically for the use of the abuelas.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. The three-day ceasefire in Gaza is due to expire tomorrow. The hope is that indirect talks brokered by Egypt will lead to a more lasting truce between Israel and Hamas. We'll see what tomorrow actually brings. Meanwhile, the ceasefire has given Gaza residents a chance to survey the destruction all around them. Here's how one of those residents describes what he saw today.
It's like I had been hit by a major earthquake.
That's Azmi Kashawi, a journalist who lives in Gaza City. We spoke with him before during the war. Today he told me about the surreal scenes he's seen just walking around Gaza. And I should warn you, some of the details you're about to hear are quite graphic.
A whole neighborhood was wiped off the face of this earth. You know, on my visit to Beit Hanun, there were a family. And in that family, I found some people digging in the dirt or in the rubble of their house. And they told me horrible things, that 2 days ago they had dug three legs out and one head, and the rest of eight bodies, they're still under rubble. And they were afraid that the ceasefire will be over before they be able to dig out the rest of their loved one.
If that's what they're occupied with right now, just finding parts of their loved ones, how do they carry on with the rest of the day? What are they doing?
You see people, sitting in front of their houses. It just breaks your heart, to see how those people, all their memories, all their dreams, all their future and past had been wiped away. All seeing mosques, the only thing left from over than 50 mosques is sometimes the minaret of the mosque, or schools, it has no walls. The amount of damage for the infrastructure used by civilians is the most devastating.
When we last spoke with you, Azmi, you were telling us about you and others who live in this 15-story building in Gaza, all with backpacks lined up at the door in case you had to flee with no notice. Is that still the case? Are those backpacks still lined up?
Last night and this morning, my wife and my little daughter, especially the young ones, were worried. What's going to happen? What's going to happen? You see, the closer we get to the end of the ceasefire, you can see the fear on their eyes. They hope the ceasefire will renew and you don't have to go through the horrible experience again.
So with the ceasefire ending tonight, even if there is not a resumption of hostilities, would you let your kids out to play tomorrow?
No, they will not leave the house unless there is another ceasefire. But, as a Palestinian, for me now, I don't want it to end like this. As a Palestinian, my hope and my dream that the siege will be lifted and my kids will be able to start dreaming again about a better future. Their school had been hit, their university of my two of my kids had been hit, the school of my other son had been hit. We have no electricity at all. We have very salty water. They destroyed most of the hospitals. It's a bit hard.
I can imagine that Gazans are sick and tired of the cycle of build, destroy, build, destroy. Azmi, you're talking about your kids being able to start dreaming again. With this cycle, when can they dream?
I know a lot of Palestinians have stopped dreaming, because they cannot afford to dream even, And nobody's giving them hope in the future. They are not putting any light at the end of their tunnels. It's a bit hard,
Well, we certainly wish you some light at the end of the tunnel soon. Azmi Keshawi, journalist who lives in Gaza City, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you.
As we mentioned, the three-day ceasefire between Israel and Hamas seems to be holding for now. The two sides are still negotiating terms of a more permanent ceasefire, but there's some sense that the war may be over, and both sides are taking stock of what happened over the past month. One topic of debate in Israel surrounds a controversial military doctrine that was employed during the fighting. Daniel Estrin has a story from Jerusalem.
The Israeli military's cantor sings the mournful Jewish prayer for the dead at this week's funeral for 2nd Lieutenant Hadar Golden. Last Friday, Palestinian militants ambushed Israeli troops near the opening of a tunnel. Then they dragged Golden into the tunnel. Israeli soldiers responded with a massive bombardment of the area. Lieutenant Colonel Peter Lerner explains.
As part of our attempt to try and cordon off the terrorists' escape route, the potential escape route, that is what we're doing.
What they were doing was invoking the Hannibal Doctrine. Military officials have sworn the name was randomly generated by a computer, but it still carries a lot of symbolism. Hannibal was the ancient Carthaginian military commander who killed himself rather than being taken alive by the Roman enemy. The Israeli military's Hannibal Doctrine instructs soldiers to fire heavily if a comrade is taken captive by the enemy, even at the risk of killing the captive soldier. Daniel Nisman served in the Israeli army and is now a geopolitical consultant. He says in Israel, the ethos is you don't abandon your soldiers in the battlefield.
Everyone gives their sons and daughters to the military, and they expect the military to return them.
Even at the expense of returning them dead, he says. In 2006, Hamas militants captured an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, on the Gaza border. By the time troops on the ground got permission from superiors to invoke the Hannibal Doctrine, the militants had taken the soldier deep into Gaza. 5 years later, Israel freed more than 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in exchange for his release. Nisman says after Shalit, the Hannibal Doctrine was revised to allow the commanders on the ground to fire immediately without waiting for the okay. That's what happened last week when 2nd Lieutenant Golden was captured. But in the bombardment that continued for a number of days, more than 100 Palestinian civilians were killed. And this time, Israel didn't warn Palestinian civilians in Gaza of the impending strike, Nisman says.
If this is a major strategic objective, they're not going to have time to let somebody in a house know, okay, you have here's an SMS, get out of there, because one of those people could be the kidnappers. So it's basically a case where I don't see how any other military wouldn't have done differently.
There are voices in Israel questioning the Hannibal Doctrine's use that day. The left-leaning Haaretz Daily ran an editorial calling for a, quote, thorough and exhaustive investigation into what happened to examine whether it involved, quote, intolerable harm to an innocent civilian population. 29-year-old Avner Gvaryahu is part of an organization of former soldiers who criticize the army's actions in the Palestinian territories. He says his group, Breaking the Silence, is beginning to solicit testimonies from soldiers who served in Gaza this past month. They want to hear firsthand what happened in the battlefield.
I think the point that we can make and where our voice is important is first of all, to make sure there is a moral discussion. And the moral discussion has to be about value of life for soldiers, of course, but also for Palestinians.
At 2nd Lieutenant Golden's funeral, a full-sized casket draped in an Israeli flag was lowered into the ground. But his body was never recovered. Only blood-soaked parts of his uniform and some human tissue were found. The Israeli military says forensic evidence proves Golden was killed in the initial Palestinian attack, not by Israeli troops firing back. Shlomo Deutsch, one of thousands of Israelis who attended the funeral, has a son who served in Gaza during this conflict. He says he supports the Hannibal Doctrine, even if it would be directed at his own son.
If something happened with my son and Hamas pick up him, the better the friend, his friend, kill him. Don't go with the Hamas in the life. It's better because for the country it's better. Because we can't, it's impossible to pay what they want to pay.
By holding a funeral over his scant remains, Deutsch says the soldier's family refused Hamas a bargaining chip. For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
If you had a loved one who was ill with an incurable, often fatal virus, and there was an experimental serum that might keep them alive, you'd probably want them to take it. That might be how the families of Kent Brantley and Nancy Wrightbull feel. They're the two Americans who were infected with Ebola in Liberia. They each got a dose of an experimental serum to counter the disease. Before that, the serum, which is called ZMAP, had only been tested on primates. No one in Africa has gotten the same treatment. The use of that serum is raising all kinds of ethical questions. Kevin Fitzgerald is a medical ethicist at Georgetown University. He's also, by the way, a Jesuit priest. He says one of the first considerations is the fact that the serum was basically untested.
Even when you give a drug that has been what we consider to be rigorously tested, once you move from one species to another, there's always the possibility that there can be differences in how that particular species reacts to a treatment rather than the animals it's been tested on. And so it could go from anywhere from it not functioning well at all to actually causing harm. And I think this was part of the risk. Now, in this situation, there is an approach which is called compassionate use, which means that, you know, someone is dying and they're dying imminently. And so the question is the risk worth it in terms of the reality of these people in imminent risk of death? And so that is one of the ethical reasoning processes we use in order to say, okay, even though we don't know what this is going to do, if the only other alternative is death and the idea of giving this vaccine is to prevent death, then it might be worth the risk. One of the issues that could come up then is, well, what if it makes the person more ill? Well, if you're dying from Ebola, I'm not sure you can become much more ill.
There were only three doses of ZMAP. Two of them have been used. If Big Pharma could reproduce ZMAP at a larger scale, would they kind of agree to compassionate use for hundreds of Africans?
Well, I mean, so one, again, has to get to the question of, does it really work? So if one had a lot of the drug, my guess would be they would already now be using it in clinical trials to test it to see, A, if it is safe, and secondly, if it is efficacious. Does it really work? Now, unfortunately, my understanding is the way they are making this particular treatment, it is not going to be all that easy to ramp it up in the near future, although they're going to work on that. But what we're talking about is perhaps months, and the Ebola, you know, crisis is with us now. And what we need to do is address what we can do now, which, of course, as everybody says, are public health measures that are known to be efficacious.
That also tips to the issue of race, of why two white Americans got the serum and none of the African victims of Ebola got it. I mean, many have raised this issue. How do you see that coming into play?
Well, I wasn't there, but I don't think it's so much a matter of race as it might be of socioeconomic background. Now, what has to be taken into consideration is these are two people who were not from that part of the world, who volunteered to go there to help the people who are there address this tragic healthcare crisis. Part of the reason there is a crisis there, my understanding is they just don't have the infrastructure they need to fight this disease. And that is in part a socioeconomic situation. What we need to do as a species, you know, as a global society, is recognize the fact that the people there on the ground do not have the tools that they need to successfully combat this disease. It is not a highly contagious disease, although it's extremely infectious. So we know there are ways to prevent this disease from moving forward. That, if one wants to ask the social justice question and the ethics question, I think is the one we really need to wrestle with.
Kevin Fitzgerald is a Jesuit priest, and he holds a chair in healthcare ethics at Georgetown University. Thanks very much for thinking this through with us.
You're most welcome.
Still ahead on The World, in Argentina, a family reunited and the science behind it on PRI. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. I've never been to Abu Dhabi, but when I look at the temperatures there in the summer, I know it's a place I only want to go in the winter. In extreme heat like that, all you'd want to do is stay in your air-conditioned room. But the thousands of migrants who are building Abu Dhabi's many glamorous new structures, they don't have much choice. They have to be in the heat. And that's just one of the terrible conditions they have to work under. Molly Crabapple is an artist and columnist for the online magazine Vice. She visited Abu Dhabi and reported a story about what the workers there deal with. She told me about one of them, a man named Ibrahim.
Ibrahim is a young South Asian man who works for a construction company in Abu Dhabi and who worked as my translator on the story. He is a brilliant kid. He speaks five languages. When he was in his home country, he actually translated for an international NGO. But unfortunately, local militants were killing locals who collaborated with foreigners, and he had to leave town, which is how he ended up in Abu Dhabi. And when he came to Saadiyat Island to work, he actually told his boss, hell is better than here. His boss said, well, why don't you go to hell then? And Ibrahim, in addition to being smart as hell, was so skeptical of the society and that would sort of place men like him into this subservient position just because they were South Asian and just because they were blue collar. And I think that's one of the reasons that he chose to translate for me, because he wanted the stories of guys like him to be told.
So Saadiyat Island that you just mentioned, that's this place where the branches of the Louvre and the Guggenheim and New York University are being constructed, right?
Saadiyat Island is an island just off of the coast of this sort of central city of Abu Dhabi that TDIC, the state-owned construction company, is transforming into a cultural paradise. There's going to be NYU, Louvre, Guggenheim, a national museum, as well as very, very fancy hotels and golf courses and lots of fancy shopping. But right now, it's essentially a construction site.
Right. And so where does Ibrahim live when he's working on the construction site? I mean, is he on Saadiyat Island or does he have to commute?
Ibrahim lives at something called a worker's city. These are housing projects for workers, all male, that are set deep, deep within the desert, very, very far from central Abu Dhabi. The goal is to isolate the workers so that Emiratis and wealthy foreigners don't actually have to look at them. The guys on these worker cities live 10 to a room in this sort of desolate Pyongyang-style atmosphere. There's literally nothing for them. There's a mosque, there's a supermarket, and then there's just this merciless sun. When I went out to a worker's city, I saw guys actually hiding beneath the buses that would take them to job sites just to be able to get a little bit of shade.
Wow. So aside from that, what kind of living conditions does Ibrahim have when he's, you know, at this camp?
Ibrahim sleeps 10 guys to a room. The food all comes from a communal cafeteria. He showed me video of what it was like to have a meal. They didn't even shell out so that the workers could have individual cups. So instead you had 20 guys sharing one pitcher of water that they were drinking directly from. The food gives lots of people low-level food poisoning, but the workers aren't even allowed to cook in their own rooms. There's one day off a week. All of the buses that take people to the job sites are not air conditioned. So workers are, you know, stuck in traffic for an hour, 2 hours trying to get to work in over 100 degree heat.
So this all sounds kind of very insidious, this world of labor in Abu Dhabi. What kind of reaction did you get from New York University and the museums like the Louvre and the Guggenheim when you asked about this kind of world that they're abetting?
NYU and the Louvre didn't respond. The Guggenheim responded by falsely accusing me of being a member of an activist organization that is protesting their work on Abu Dhabi and by claiming I had conflicts of interest. And then they gave me a canned statement.
And no other reaction from the others?
No other reaction from them. And the thing about Abu Dhabi that's so important is it's not that Abu Dhabi is particularly evil with labor, it's that it's very, very explicit. The United States also runs on the labor of people who are paid far less than minimum wage and who can get deported at whim. These people are called undocumented migrants. However, the U.S., while it's completely dependent on these people's labor, says, oh no, they're criminals, they're not official, we never encouraged them to come here, and maintains a distance from it, whereas Abu Dhabi has institutionalized this method of exploitation.
I mean, I got to say, this is not news, these labor conditions in the Gulf. Is word getting out in India and Bangladesh and Nepal that the Emirates are not that dream that you all think it is?
It is getting out. There is actually a reality TV show in Kerala whose name translates to Workers' World. This show is one where producers find workers that were disappeared in the Gulf, whether through poverty, through jail, through abuse, through crime, and they rescue them and they reunite them with their families. When labor abuses are so well known that there's a reality TV show devoted to them, that does mean that people know about it. However, people also come to the Gulf not just because of money, but because they're from crisis zones. I met many people who were fleeing violence in Kashmir or in Nepal or in the northwest frontier in Pakistan and came to the Gulf because they thought that, oh, this will be safe.
Molly Crabapple, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Writer Deepak Singh is back in India. He lives in South Bend, Indiana, but Deepak grew up in Lucknow, where he's spending the summer. It's given him a chance to catch up with family and some family traditions.
I'm the eldest of three siblings. I have one sister, and she's 3 years younger than me. As kids, we played, laughed, and had fun together. But when we fought, if she cried, even when it wasn't my fault, my father would tell me to be nice to her. Growing up in India, my parents always reminded me that it was my duty to take care of my sister. The responsibility was not a small one. They told me that I would have to protect her, be there when she needed help, find her a suitable husband, make sure she was happy in her marriage. And if for some reason the marriage failed or her husband died, I would have to take care of her for the rest of her life. My family is not an exception in this regard. In most Hindu families in India, parents raise their sons with this idea. To be the keeper of your sister is second nature for every brother. It's not even a question. And to celebrate this bond between brothers and sisters, there's a festival called Raksha Bandhan. It's a Hindu holiday, but it's been celebrated by people of every religion in India for hundreds of years. A few days before the festival, almost every street in India is lined with glittering stalls. Boxes full of mithai, Indian sweets, get sent around the country and abroad. On Raksha Bandhan, millions of sisters tie a rakhi, a sacred thread, on their brother's wrist. And if you don't have a sister or a brother, you celebrate with cousins or friends. My sister and I have shared this bond for almost 40 years. And every year, on the day of the festival, I have vowed to take care of her. But so far, she has never asked for help. Instead, it is my sister who has looked after me, cared for me, and called me to find out if I was doing well. For the past 11 years, she has sent me rakhis to the U.S. This year, I'm in India, and I'm lucky to have her tie the sacred thread on my wrist in person.
That was our friend Deepak Singh in India. I have a sister, but we've never celebrated Raksha Bandhan. Maybe we should. How about you? If Raksha Bandhan is part of your tradition, we want to hear about it. Send us your stories and your photos. Just go to PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Sunni militants keep gaining ground in Iraq. We'll hear about the Kurdish Peshmerga fighters battling them and meet the Peshmerga's highest-ranking female commander. And later, how a rapper in San Diego is raising awareness about the plight of Iraqis.
I wasn't just a rapper anymore. It was like I was a spokesperson for these people.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. Rapid gains by Sunni militants in northern Iraq may prompt the U.S. to act. There were reports today that President Obama is considering airstrikes to help stem the advance. The White House won't confirm that, but the fact is the Islamic State militant group continues to gain ground, most recently at the expense of Kurdish forces known as the Peshmerga. The Peshmerga are struggling to defend a 650-mile-long front line against the militants. At the southern tip of that front line is Jalula, a town just 80 miles away from Baghdad. Marine Olivezi traveled there with the Peshmerga's only female colonel.
Three SUVs leave the Kurdish town of Sulaymaniyah. We're heading to Jalula on the front line. Riding with us, half a dozen Peshmerga, among them one woman.
Your daughter?
We're not out of the city yet, but her phone has already rung twice. First her daughter, then her husband.
All I have is just one kid, and he's not able to handle that for me. While I'm gone. Kurdish men are very lazy as far as, you know, householding, housekeeping. Like babysitting and taking care of the house while the wife is gone, they're pretty much useless.
Meet Colonel Nahida Ahmed Rashid, the highest-ranking female commander in the Peshmerga force. She's 50 now, but joined the Kurdish nationalist movement in her teens. Then Iraqi authorities under Saddam Hussein started looking for her, so she escaped to the mountains where other Kurdish insurgents were fleeing. Now she's a colonel, the only female one. She earns the same wage as her male counterparts, just about $1,000 a month. Colonels in the Iraqi army make about twice that. But bottom line, Nahida says money can't buy loyalty.
Peshmerga has the, what you call, believing in the cause. So they fight for no money. They fight for their people.
As we talk, the colonel gets another phone call. This time, it's from the front line.
The force down in Jalawla made the colonel to do some shopping for them.
So she's on the phone with them now?
Yeah. Like, we need some toothbrush, some toothpaste, some soaps, some detergents. Yeah, tell me what else you need.
At a bazaar in a nearby town, Nahida meets a general who's also heading south. They greet each other in a soap and detergent alley. Then crack jokes about the best herbal shampoo for the fighters. When it's time to pay, most shop owners won't take their money. We jump back in the car. As we approach the front line, the mood changes. Nahida and the other fighters mount their sniper rifles and turn on their walkie-talkies.
She look around the area and between the trees. It's like bad area right now, not controlled by 100%. You might find some IEDs on this road. You might receive small arms fire from the houses around this area. So you have to be very careful. Look around you. Try to drive fast in this area.
Nahida sticks her Kalashnikov out of the window every time we pass by an Arab village. There are also extra measures taken because of her. The Peshmerga believe the presence of a female commander makes the convoy a bigger target.
We're using a code name for the commander, calling her with a male name, Muhammad, Mr. Muhammad. So if the enemy is monitoring the transmission on the radio, wouldn't find out there's a female commander among them.
We finally arrive at their makeshift base, a shack made of braided straw. Straight ahead, less than a mile away, starts the Islamic State's self-declared caliphate.
It's in that village. Last night and 3 nights ago, they were trying to sneak into, you know, get behind our lines in the areas to the south and southwest, and we just, you know, sent him away.
Nahida listens to the latest updates. Some of the men here are relatives. Many are veterans. Ahmed Karim is 74. He's been a Peshmerga for nearly 50 years. He's fought four Iraqi presidents. And he says radical Islamists are worse. Saddam Hussein was ruthless, he says, but he didn't cut people's throat. Kurds have to adapt to their strategy. For decades, they were the ones fighting a regular army, guerrilla style. Now the tables have turned. The Peshmerga are on the defensive, facing what they say is an unknown, unseen enemy. Nahida makes one last tour before taking off. Her battalion doesn't operate here. She just came to support and supply the fighters. She tells them they can call her anytime, no matter what they need. One veteran replies, "We're in this together, and for the long run." For the world, I'm Marine Olivesi in Jalula.
In Russia, gourmands are freaking out. It's because of the Russian government's new ban on food imports from the West. The year-long ban covers meat, fish, fruit, vegetables, and dairy products from the U.S., Canada, most of Western Europe, and Australia. Our friend in Moscow resident Charles Maines put the ban in perspective for me.
Well, Marco, have you ever had a really, really good piece of French brie?
I have. I love a good runny brie. And it's out for Russians for the next year. Charles says the ban is both in retaliation for Western sanctions against Russia and a move to bump up domestic food production, which he says many Russians won't be happy about.
There is this kind of reputation of Russian goods and is not being on the same level of quality as some of the import goods. You know, there's a word that gets touted around here called savok, which comes from the word Soviet, but it's sort of a derogatory term. And I think that's the attitude a lot of people have. If they have the money, they'll buy, they'll upgrade to the Western goods often, but maybe they won't have a choice anymore.
So cheese, nice fish and meat produce. What are some of the other things that people are really worried about their inability to find anymore?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting that they're not apparently have to worry about is booze. So liquor was not on this list. And I think that's a very strategic move by the Kremlin. You know, President Putin basically signed a decree that was posted to the Kremlin website. The Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, was left to sort of sort out the details. And that seems to be kind of his sort of role around here, is to kind of do the work that nobody else wants to do. But still, he just issued a statement and there was nothing on television, nothing on radio. In other words, no face or voice attached to these measures, which I think says a lot about how Russians might feel about it.
So I'm curious to know how this ban is playing among older Russians who lived through empty store shelves during the Cold War.
Well, exactly. There is this sort of back to the future kind of quality to all this. And, you know, Russians of a certain age will remember the queues and lines of the Soviet period, the lack of goods and foodstuffs in the stores. You know, and again, the Russian government is obviously trying to take measures to avoid that. But on social media and on the internet of today, there was, of course, lots of jokes, and Russians have a great sense of humor. You know, one of my favorites that came up was this idea that, you know, the next country to issue sanctions against Russia was, you know, well, wait for it, Russia.
So how much damage do you think this is actually going to have on the West? Who's going to hurt the most?
Well, already, you know, certainly some countries in the EU, for example, Finland, some of their agricultural products go to Russia. They're quite popular here. I think you'll see certainly some kickback in a lot of different directions. But, you know, I think that, again, the issue is who's it hurting more? And I think there's a little bit of a sense that this is kind of, while it is the Russian government taking aim at these countries that have issued sanctions against it, there is also a sense of kind of shooting itself in the foot.
With Vladimir Putin riding a wave of popularity right now after the Olympics and taking over Crimea and doing what he's been doing, we assume, supporting Eastern Ukraine separatists, how's this going to impact him?
Well, we'll see. I mean, you know, this is what the Russian sort of rabbit in the hat is, that, of course, they point to his approval ratings these days keep going up and up. Today, there was a new poll that issued that said it reached a record high of 87%. 66% of people in Russia say they believe Russia is moving in the right direction. But, you know, keep in mind, this is before they took away the cheese. So we'll see.
Right. And meantime, have you been stocking up on French cheese? I know you love that brie.
I do like that brie. You know, I actually picked up a few extra bits, and I have some friends coming over tonight. I'm going to treat them to it. It might be the last. But, you know, to get, you know, serious about this, I think, you know, the bigger issue is how Russians will react to this move. I mean, you know, of course, there's always been this sort of vocal opposition, which I think in the West we hear a lot about, or anti-Putin. But I think the important thing is that a lot of people who support Putin are actually not interested in politics. They've never been politically active particularly, and they like Putin because he doesn't ask them to be particularly active. And if you look at, you know, what Putin's achieved over these last, you know, 14 years, it's primarily stability. And, you know, it's kind of like a social contract here. He took care of the government and politics, but it allowed other people to just take care of their lives, you know, and they made money, they traveled to Europe, and they bought, you know, stylish clothes. And it was this kind of very entrenched consumer culture that I think in its own paradoxical way was sort of a form of freedom. And what's strange to me anyway, as we look at what's going on with these sanctions and other events that are happening in Russian society, is you see the government sort of crowding into the lives of people in ways that they didn't before. And you know, will people ultimately say that this was, you know, a move that the Kremlin had to make to defend ourselves? Or will they say that, hey, you know, this isn't the deal we had?
Our friend Charles Maines in Moscow, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
Yesterday, we brought you the incredible story of Estela De Carlotto. She's the head of the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo, the group that spearheaded the search for the hundreds of babies stolen by Argentina's military dictatorship during the country's dirty war decades ago. Well, De Carlotto has just been reunited with her own stolen grandson with the help of a DNA test. Today, I want to tell you about another remarkable part of the story, how the grandmother's struggle in Argentina spurred an effort to develop new genetic techniques that can be used to identify the missing children and to reunite them with their biological families. Geneticist Mary Claire King, a professor at the University of Washington in Seattle, has led this effort since 1984. I asked Dr. King today how she ended up working with the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo in the first place.
The Grandmothers came to me in 1983 through friends of friends. I had worked in Chile during the Unidad Popular. I love Latin America. I'm the age of their daughters who were being kidnapped and murdered, and my daughter is the age of their missing grandchildren. So both for scientific and for personal reasons, it seemed like a perfect match.
So by the time you joined their effort, the military dictatorship in Argentina had been replaced by a democratic government, and the grandmothers already had years' worth of data, I'd assume, and anecdotal evidence that helped identify many of the missing children. Why was scientific proof of kinship so important?
The grandmothers had splendid circumstantial evidence that stolen children were appearing in various parts of the country. But what they needed to know was not simply who a child was not. That is, that the child was not, in fact, the biological child of the people who were pretending that it was their child, but, in fact, who a child was. And for that purpose, we needed to develop a new approach for them.
So if I get this right, you use mitochondrial DNA to identify the stolen babies. Explain that for the layperson and start with what mitochondrial DNA is exactly.
Mitochondrial DNA is a very special molecule. It's DNA. It's present in every cell. But it's inherited only from mothers. It's different than all the rest of the DNA, which, of course, we share with both parents. The other great virtue of mitochondrial DNA is that there's a bit of it that is highly variable, the most highly variable bit of DNA in the entire genome. So we were able to exploit these two splendid features of mitochondrial DNA very, very early on in the days of DNA sequencing. We were still sequencing by hand in those days, literally reading off every base pair to each other, in order to develop an approach for the abuelas that would allow them to match individual children who were found with women who might be their maternal grandmothers, or indeed with persons who might be their purely maternal relatives as aunts, great aunts, cousins, and so on.
So you basically innovated this genetic technology, almost bespoke for the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo for Argentina.
The grandmothers like to say that this proves that God is a woman because she put mitochondrial DNA on Earth specifically for the use of the abuelas. And years later, after the program CSI became popular and, of course, includes mitochondrial DNA sequencing, the grandmothers say, we are abuelas CSI. So, yeah, we did.
So Estela De Carlotto has just been reunited with her stolen grandson after 37 years. How did you feel when you heard that news?
Oh, I'm just on cloud nine. I was absolutely sure that if her grandson, if Guido, had survived and was still in the country, that she would eventually find him. And he found her.
And how many other kids in Argentina who have undergone this tragic kind of history have you been able to reunite with their families?
The abuelas have reunited 109 children now with their biological families, and I just work for them.
Wow. Dr. King, just wondering if there are uses for the genetic technologies that you've helped develop that could be applied to other humanitarian efforts.
Oh, well, that technology is now used worldwide for the identification of missing persons. We used the mitochondrial DNA sequencing approach to identify our soldiers who had gone missing in action from Vietnam, in Cambodia, from the Korean War, even from World War II. It was used after 9/11 to identify people who'd been killed then. It is now a routine part of analysis of remains.
Dr. Mary Claire King, professor of genetics and medicine at the University of Washington in Seattle, thanks very much for talking to us about this.
My great pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Just ahead, reconnecting with Iraq one rhyme at a time on The World from PRI.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo, unifying cable, on-demand, and streaming apps like Netflix without the need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or user experience. More at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World on your radio. So if a monkey takes a selfie with your camera, whose picture is it? That is not a philosophical question along the lines of a tree falling in the forest. Maybe you saw this story. The camera belonged to British photographer David Slater. As he told our partners at the BBC, he was in Indonesia a few years ago when he decided to try an experiment.
I spent several days following a troop of these little crested black macaques around, so much so that they became very happy in my presence, began to look interested in my camera, set the camera up on a tripod, and I just knew they would come along, play with the camera, and hey, bingo, they'd take their own picture.
And that's exactly what one female black macaque did. Her selfie is not only priceless, with her toothy smile and bright red eyes beaming at the camera, it's in focus and pretty well composed. Slater sold it to a bunch of magazines. Even though he didn't technically take the picture, he says that the photo is his property.
I claim it is, yeah. I mean, I had the vision of that, even though people say, oh, vision isn't part of copyright. But I definitely did the sweat and tears of it. I processed the image since. Why shouldn't it be my copyright?
The problem is the photo popped up on Wikipedia, which, much to Slater's dismay, pretty much puts it into the public domain. The photographer says he's lost tens of thousands of dollars in earnings as a result. He's demanding that Wikipedia and its parent, the Wikimedia Foundation, take the picture down because they have no right to publish his photo. The nonprofit foundation has a different take on the matter. Spokeswoman Catherine Mayer says nobody owns the copyright.
Because the monkey took the photo and the photographer, although it was his camera, didn't take that photo, there's nobody who copyright belongs to in this particular instance. It doesn't belong to the monkey. It doesn't belong to the photographer. And in cases like that, images and other works fall into the public domain. And so when something's in the public domain, it can be used by anyone for any purposes.
The standoff has left David Slater feeling trampled and ignored.
Well, I haven't heard from Wikipedia or the other people that are claiming this. They don't care about facts. They are just punting their opinion around. It's a rights grab, not just on my image, but I believe on many other photographers' images.
So that's where things stand. By the way, the black macaque monkeys in Indonesia are officially listed as a critically endangered species. We want to hear where you come down on the monkey selfie dispute. We've gone ahead and posted it on our Facebook page. Sorry, David. Fair use. We'll call it for the time being. Anyway, that monkey smile will make your day. It's at facebook.com/PRI the world. Let's turn back to Iraq for our final story today. There are more than 5 million Iraqis living outside the country, many of them refugees. Now they're watching from afar as Iraq unravels again. And one Iraqi-American rapper is using his voice to reflect that experience. From San Diego, Valerie Hamilton has more.
Tommy Hanna didn't mean to become the voice of young Iraqis abroad, he says. It just happened. Somehow, someway, someday, we gon' brothers bitch down for what they didn't upgrade. Rapping under his stage alias, Timbs, he recorded an Iraq War protest song in 2007 from an Iraqi-American point of view. Dear Mr. George Bush, why do you insist to make a fool of us? For over 200 years, we stood for what's good, now we despise by peers. The song went viral.
From one website to the next, from one blog to the next, and it was just like, I couldn't keep up with it.
Joining us now is Iraqi-American rapper Timbs.
All of a sudden, he was on Fox News, Al Jazeera, MTV, making his case against the war. He was 22.
We reached corners of the world that we never thought that it would.
Hanna was born and raised in San Diego. His parents are from Baghdad, but he hasn't been to Iraq since he was a kid, when Saddam was still in power. He started out rapping about girls, partying, and the San Diego Chargers. After his Iraq song, he says, that all changed.
I kind of got put into this position where it's like I was a de facto Iraqi American voice, a face. I wasn't just a rapper anymore. It was like I was a spokesperson for these people. And I really, you know, felt the responsibility of that.
His next release in 2010 told the stories of Iraqi refugees struggling in the U.S.
refugee in the land of the free, but nobody's in the street passing bread out to eat. And he can't find a job because no matter where he goes, they tell him sorry, just do your too old.
Hannah went on to law school. He interned at a rights organization. This summer, he was getting ready to put out a new album, Songs About Iraqi American Life. Then, in June, the Sunni extremist group ISIS seized control of parts of Iraq and declared a new war on Christians like Hannah and other religious minorities. Ethnic cleansing has driven hundreds of thousands from their homes. But Hannah says he felt wrong writing music about it.
What's happening right now is so tragic, and it's so terrible that I kind of felt like, you know, I should say something, I should do something. But at the same time, I didn't want to pop my head out and say, oh, hey, now, you know, I'm going to record a song and I'm going to put it out, because I didn't want it to be about me.
But he started getting messages from fans. The first one came from a young rapper, an Iraqi refugee in Michigan.
He sent me an email saying that he really looks up to me, you know, that the song Iraq, and he knows all my music, and he wants me to rap about the situation.
Then he got a message from an Iraqi in Australia, then from a refugee in Jordan.
Tim's, when are you going to say something about the situation? Tim's, are you going to make a song? You're the voice that we look to. And I'm okay. And it just kept coming.
Hannah is not what you'd call a famous musician. He recorded his first tracks in his bedroom closet. He works a day job and he doesn't have a record deal. But he realized he did have a platform.
I feel like somebody needs to say something. And if I don't do it myself, then I won't be able to look myself, you know, in the mirror, because I have the opportunity to do it.
So he started writing. But facing down deadly conflict with words and music isn't that easy.
I've been going back and forth for the past couple of weeks, writing lyrics and scratching them out, and writing lyrics and crossing them out. I have this microphone in front of me and people are listening to me, so I need to make sure that what I'm about to say is important.
Should the lyrics call out George W. Bush for starting the war, President Obama for pulling out U.S. troops, Prime Minister Maliki? And what kind of song do you write about terrorists like ISIS?
What do you say to them, and what can you put in a song that would have any effect?
He says he doesn't have the answer. No one does. But he has the beginnings of a song. Here's a preview.
And it goes, if I ruled the world, there would be no God. No hell, no heaven above, just love. The one commandment. It's not blasphemy if you understand it. No religion, and no Bibles, no prophets, and no idols. Just us on this little blue ball, suspended in space, trying not to fall.
Hannah plans to have the new song out online by the end of the month. For The World, I'm Valerie Hamilton, San Diego.
Y'all must have missed the facts. Let me straighten y'all up on the twisted facts. The Garden of Eden was Iraq. God made Adam and Eve in Iraq.
Iraqi American rapper Tim's takes us out today. His skills and his viral video, yep, already posted at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported in part by the PRI Global Reporting Fund, providing in-depth reporting on a diverse array of important topics, including global health. Donors to the fund include Marguerite Steed Hoffman and Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter Berge and Debbie Sitt, and Cindy and Howard Rachofsky. The WGBH Fund for Environmental Reporting, whose donors include the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment, supporting a cooperative approach to solving our critical environmental problems while we still can. And the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund, and by the National Endowment for the Arts.
PRI, Public Radio International.